You don't need special gadgets to be a hero. With unlimited 1.5% cash back on every purchase everywhere, the Capital One Quicksilver Card makes you the hero of every purchase. Whether it's headphones, a lounge chair, or even a well-deserved massage, whatever the Quicksilver purchase, you're the hero. No fighting bad guys, getting in epic car chases, or parachuting out of buildings required. Simple, isn't it? The Capital One Quicksilver Card. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. See CapitalOne.com for details.
Life in our modern age comes at you pretty fast, which makes our time away especially valuable. When I take time to relax, I like to get far from my everyday life, immerse myself in natural beauty, and have unique experiences. But you don't have to leave the U.S. to experience tropical rainforests and islands filled with adventure, warm culture, and national treasures. Visit Puerto Rico, an island with a vibrant spirit that will sweep you away. Because when you visit, you don't become part of the island, it becomes part of you. In Puerto Rico, you can forget where you came from and embrace where you are. Puerto Rico, where visits end, but stories last forever. No passport required for U.S. citizens and permanent residents. Learn more and plan your trip at discoverpuertorico.com.
Hey everyone, it's Josh, and for this week's Select, I've chosen our 2016 episode on pterosaurs. Not flying dinosaurs, pterosaurs. They were their own thing. And this episode brings out the inner child paleontologist in me. I hope it does for you too. There's only one way to find out. Sit back, relax, and enjoy the episode.
Welcome to Stuff You Should Know, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Josh Clark. There's Charles W. Chuck Bryant. It's just the two of us batching it today.
Yeah.
That's what my dad used to say if he had to take care of me while my mom was working. We're just batching it.
Was that what he said?
Yeah.
I thought that was a relatively new term.
No. I mean, at least the early 80s.
All right.
Maybe my dad was like way ahead of his time.
Why hasn't there been a movie called Batching It?
I don't know. That's
pretty obvious.
The fact that it was around as a word in the 80s makes me even more surprised that there's not a movie called Batching It.
Yeah.
That, like, the protagonist has to put on, like, a car wash to save their business or something like that?
Yeah, Owen Wilson.
What did he do?
Well, he would just be the star batching it, I imagine, right?
I guess so. Could that guy be any more charming than he is?
He's pretty charming.
Speaking of charming, Chuck, let me introduce you to a wonderful little beast named Quetzalcoatlus northropi.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar?
Sure.
So Quetzalcoatlus is named after the Aztec flying serpent god, Quetzalcoatl.
Yes.
Right? So it makes sense. But this guy was a real thing. Not to put down the Aztecs' beliefs or anything like that, but this is a verifiable beast at one point, particularly in the late Cretaceous period. And it's what you would probably call a pterodactyl. But if you call it a pterodactyl, you'd be dead wrong, pal.
Yeah.
What it really is a pterosaur. And there's a lot of misunderstandings that we're going to sort through. But the most important point is that this beast right here is 20 feet tall. As tall as a giraffe.
Man.
And it had a wingspan akin to about an F-16 fighter jet. And it was a bad mamma jamma. How's that for a lead-in?
That's good. I like it.
I didn't even use the Wayback Machine. Just trimmed the fat. Gone.
Oh, you don't even need that old clunky thing anymore?
We just use our imaginations. We're not actually in the Cretaceous period like we would be if we had used the Wayback Machine.
Oh, okay. Yeah, these Terra starts with a P, of course, a silent P.
Mm-hmm.
That is from Greek, meaning winged lizards, and that's pretty on point because they were reptiles. They were not dinosaurs.
Yes, big, big distinction here.
They're close. It's like a sister to a dinosaur, perhaps.
They're from the same clade, which is archosaurs, but it's a really wide clade. And all that means is that they have in the very remote past some single common ancestor with dinosaurs.
Yeah, and they were around roughly the same time period.
Oh,
and,
definitely.
And went away in the same fashion.
Mm-hmm.
So it's normal, I think, for people to say, look at that pterodactyl, look at that flying dinosaur, even though neither one of those is necessarily correct.
Yeah. So just to get this across one more time, Pterosaurs were not flying dinosaurs. They were flying reptiles, but they weren't dinosaurs. They weren't birds either. And to confuse things even further, there were birds around at the time of the dinosaurs and the time of the pterosaurs. And to confuse things even further, there were such things as actual flying dinosaurs. We call them velociraptors.
Right. And these vertebrates actually were flying long before birds and bats by like millions and millions of years.
Yeah, I think this How Stuff Works article, this is a good one. I got to give big ups to Clint Pumphrey.
Yeah, pretty good. The Pumph. So,
yeah, he sounds like an action How Stuff Works writer. Yeah. Clint Pumphrey. Chest, beef rock. You know?
Uh-huh.
But he said, I think, 80 million years difference. 80 million years before.
Yeah, I mean, that's
birds.
That's a lot of years.
It is. So there's a lot of, like, confusing stuff flying around. And I think there's one other thing we should probably address right out of the gate is that you shouldn't call them pterodactyls, even though a lot of people do. Pterodactyls are actually a specific genus of pterosaurs. So to call all pterosaurs pterodactyls would be incorrect, but you could call all pterodactyls pterosaurs. Okay?
Yeah, and technically, like, if you have seen this thing in movies a lot that they say that's a pterodactyl, what you've probably been looking at this whole time is one of the species, and they're, you know, potentially up to 200 of these species. Right now, I think they've identified about 100, 130-ish. But a pteranodon, is that how you'd say it? Pteranodon?
That's what I would have gone with.
I like pteranodon.
Right.
That's probably what you've been seeing in movies all this time that you've been saying that's a pterodactyl. Like if you look up an image search of the pteranodon, you'll say that's a pterodactyl because I saw it in King Kong.
Yeah, it's like this giant winged beast with kind of short, stubby legs and a huge wingspan and like a weird crest on its head and a long, pointy beak. A pterodactyl. Everybody knows what a pterodactyl is. Don't be an idiot. Yeah, you saw it in King Kong in 1933. Saw the same thing in Jurassic Park 3 in 2001, right? Things hadn't changed all that much. But in that time span, it's actually kind of surprising because our understanding of pterosaurs had increased dramatically, and yet we were still just basically thinking of them exclusively as pterodactyls, which isn't the case.
Yeah, there was a paleontologist named O.C. Marsh, who it's a pretty good name for a paleontologist.
Sure.
He collected these first fossils in what is now and was then Western Kansas in the late 1800s, like 1870. And they've been Well, I was about to say they've been digging up lots of these since then. They sort of have, but not nearly as many as other types of fossils because these fossils are really highly breakable and dissolvable, and they're tough to get a hold of and keep in one piece throughout the process.
Yeah, we should talk about that. Like, one of the reasons there is so little understanding of pterosaurs is because they don't fossilize very well.
Nah.
Because their bones were not designed to be fossilized, they were designed to allow these giant reptiles to fly.
Yeah, they didn't say like, oh, we need to be designed to leave our mark later.
No.
They're just like, we want to fly.
Right, exactly. So early on, I think the first pterodon or the first pterosaur specimen was found in the late 18th century in Germany. And by the time O.C. Marsh was digging them up 100 years later in Kansas, They'd been discovered, but they'd also just kind of been abandoned because there were very few follow-up fossils that were identified, right?
Yeah.
So when O.C. Marsh started to dig them up, this was a big deal. And because he was finding virtually all of the same species, the pteranodon, that became the common conception of the what the pterosaur is, but it was coupled with an earlier name, pterodactyl, that had been given to the entire species or the entire group by Georges Cuvier in, I think, 1812.
Yeah, and that first fossil you're talking about, no one got credit for that, for digging that thing up. But like you said, it was in Germany in limestone, like 150 million-year-old limestone, late in the 18th century. That eventually found its way to a man with a great name, Cosimo Alessandro Collini.
That's a great one. Man, when I first came across this in this article, I was like, I'm looking forward to hearing Chuck say that guy's name.
That's him. He was Italian, go figure, and he was a natural scientist. And he, like many others to follow for a long time, didn't really know what it was. Since he they found that in an ancient lagoon with all kinds of seafaring creatures, he understandably thought it was a seafaring creature.
Yeah. And some of the best preserved fossils that we have of these things are found in things like lagoons, where something happened to them. They died suddenly, quickly, fell into a body of water, which probably broke their fall a little bit. They landed at the muck and were covered up, potentially in some anaerobic, anaerobic state, and eventually became fossilized very gently. That's what it takes to fossilize a pterosaur.
Yeah, and Cuvier, who kind of got it all wrong by calling it a pterodactyl for everyone in the future. He was actually the same dude, though, who did say, actually, I think those are wings, not paddles.
Right.
And that was, you know, a big breakthrough.
Yeah, and the reason he called them pterodactyls, it means wing finger in the Greek. Right? So pterosaur means winged lizard, and pterodactyl means wing finger because, as we'll see, the front edge of the wing, the leading edge of the wing, is actually an extraordinarily long pinky.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
I think so, too. That's a good way to lead up to a break, too, don't you think?
Agreed.
Let's go.
Oh, the stuff we learned from Josh and Chuck. Stuff you should.
Hey everybody, Chuck here. Are you thirsty? Well, before you take a sip, have you stopped to think about what's in your water? Many conventional bottled waters contain PFAS, harmful substances known as forever chemicals.
Yeah, but you can drink water as clean as nature intended with Richard's Rainwater.
That's right. Richard's Rainwater collects 100% pure, refreshing drops of rain. Yes, it really is rain. Richard's Rainwater is caught clean before it hits the ground or becomes polluted with pesticides and contaminants that are commonly found in groundwater.
And since rain is naturally pure, there's no need for harsh chemicals or additives. That means Richard's Rainwater contains no added fluoride, no chlorine, no forever chemicals, no microplastics, no nothing. Just pure drops of rain.
That's right. Enjoy the smooth, clean taste of Richard's still rainwater and the long-lasting cold pressured bubbles of Richard's sparkling rainwater, perfect for sipping or mixing into your favorite cocktail. Just visit richardsrainwater.com to find a retailer near you. Enjoy pure, refreshing rainwater. Sip the sky. Hey, everybody. It's halftime and the scoreboard is not looking good. You're feeling low and not sure you can pull out a win. And that's when you have to dig deep, lift your head up, and say to yourself, time to get back in the game. Pull off some bank heists and take as much of your friend's money as you possibly can.
That's right. The smash hit mobile game Monopoly Go lets you compete with your friends to get the most riches and the biggest empire. It's the Monopoly you love, but on your phone, anytime, with tons of new twists, including leaderboards to compare your progress to your buddies.
That's right. You can play on countless dynamic Monopoly boards. You can make your friends bankrupt by smashing their landmarks with a wrecking ball, and you can charge other players rent for your iconic properties.
Plus, you can even work with your friends to crack open community chests in tournaments to get rewards and climb the leaderboard.
So get back out there, put on your game face, and download Monopoly Go, now free on the App Store or Google Play. Hey, everybody. You know, asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest.
That's right. They're committed to high ethical standards and even had to pass a rigorous exam before they could become a CFP professional. They offer financial planning services that take a more comprehensive view of your financial and personal circumstances, and they customize them for your needs.
That's right. Certified financial planner professionals can offer advice on a wide range of issues like reviewing your investment portfolio's allocation, handling an inheritance, rolling over a company retirement plan, building education savings, and so much more. And that's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
Well, now, when you're on the road, driving in your truck, why not learn a thing or two from Josh and Chuck? It's stuff you should know.
Stuff you should know.
All right.
Okay, we're back. I feel like we kind of jumbled things up like a bunch of pterosaur bones.
Sure.
So let's reset here, shall we?
Should we reset with the head?
Let's.
The head crests. If you've seen a movie like Jurassic Park, mm-hmm. and you saw what you thought was a pterodactyl, and he had that beautiful looking, he or she, well, maybe he, because now they think that maybe only the males
yeah.
had these head crests.
Mm-hmm.
These things were sort of one of the staples of many, if not all, of these species, but they were all really different and some fantastic looking, and they're not exactly sure. There's still a lot of debate over what they use these big crests for.
Yeah, they thought maybe they use them as a rudder in the air to steer with as
Makes
they're
sense.
Flying around. It does make sense. Some people thought that they maybe used them as a marine rudder. Maybe they used them for defense because they were like made of horn and bone
yeah.
covered with skin. And they think possibly they had coloring to them. Maybe they had feathers or light fur. They're not quite sure. But because there's just such a lack of understanding and because pterosaur fossils are so few and far between, it's still basically anybody's guess what they were used for. But then I think in Germany, and I'm not exactly certain when this was discovered, but a female pterosaur was discovered. She had an egg in her oviduct still.
Mm-hmm.
So it was the only pterosaur to ever be positively identified by sex in the history of the world. And she lacked that head crest. So it really lent support to the idea that it was males only, kind of like how a peacock has the very bright feathers and the peahen does not. They think that maybe it's the same thing or more akin to like antlers in deer or moose. The males are the ones that have the antlers and they think they use it maybe a little bit for defense, but mostly to say, hey, I'm a dude and I'm looking for some action. Check out the size of my antlers. They think it was probably the same with pterosaurs now.
Yeah, and these things, like, it's amazing when you look up these pictures. Some of them are just really fantastically colored. Some of them are really big, like that Tapajara Imperator.
Yeah, if you look up one pterosaur during this episode, make it this guy.
Yeah, this is cool. This thing looks like it literally has a sailboat sail on top of its head.
And if the coloring is anywhere remotely like what the artist's conceptions are, it just must have been something to see.
Yeah, that Nyctosaurus is pretty interesting, too. This one didn't seem to have any sort of it looked like a sail without the sail. Like, what do you call the frame of the sail? I'm sure there's some great name for it.
The timber.
Sure. But these, I mean, it's they liken it in this article, the pump does, to television antennae, and they are really big and look only clunky to me.
Yeah, I mean, it'd be good for skewering, I guess, but it could also be terrible for skewering. Like if you were hunting or spearing fish with it, you could probably catch a lot of fish, but you couldn't get the fish off because these antennae were just way too tall and long.
Yeah, and then this Pterodustro is really, you should look that one up too. It's pretty amazing. This one looks like if a dinosaur mated with a pelican
mm-hmm.
and a toothbrush.
Yeah, I saw one person describe it as a toothbrush with wings.
Yeah, the lower jaw has like 1,000 really long, small, needle-like teeth, and it looks like this big toothbrushy underbite.
Yeah, and it does, like when you look at it, you're like, oh, it's clearly got to be related to a pelican. Again, it's not. Pelican's a bird, and birds were around during the time of dinosaurs. And if birds are anything, they're actually the real flying dinosaurs. But it does look a lot like it. And it makes sense that it would, because from what we're learning about pterosaurs now these days is that a lot of them were ocean going, that they had the goods to fly across an entire ocean over the course of a few days, like maybe an albatross would, and that they would fly low, some of them, and skim the surface of these ancient oceans on Earth and scoop up marine life with their jaws, with their lower jaw, just like a pelican would. So what's even more interesting about that, besides the idea that this is going on 100 million years ago, is that pelicans are not related to these things. So that this trait, this behavior, this characteristic evolved more than one time. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I find that fascinating. Rather than saying, oh, pelicans descended from that, actually they didn't. That's just two different branches of the same tree developing into something very similar.
Evolution in isolation? Isn't that what they call that?
Yeah. Or no.
No?
Convergent evolution.
Oh, okay.
I think, yes, it is. It's convergent evolution. When like a trait or a behavior or characteristic develops separately among different branches of the tree rather than developing once and then descendants all have that same trait.
Yeah, and although they did certainly love a good seafood meal, they used to think that was sort of all they ate.
Mm-hmm.
And now new research suggests that they do eat or did eat all kinds of things, even tiny dinosaurs.
Yeah, the way that they describe them now is that it's just like birds, right? You've got birds that eat all sorts of different things, that fill all sorts of different ecological niches. That's what they're coming to the conclusion about with pterosaurs, which, I mean, Chuck, this is like a huge sea change from what it was even back in the 1950s or 60s or 70s.
Oh, yeah.
When we thought there were just a few species, and it turns out there were a ton of different ones and a lot of variety and a lot of diversity, and now we're starting to kind of get a handle on that.
Yeah, and they think they were probably able, after they hatched, to fly pretty quickly, to take care of themselves pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And like you mentioned, their flying, they believe now, was they were kind of built for the long haul. Weren't super fast, but could, you know, like a long distance jetliner.
Right.
But some of them were small. Some of them were small as songbirds. And I imagine they were flitty.
Yeah, I can't remember the name of one, but there was one that was extremely tiny, a very tiny little flying pterosaur.
Could you imagine anything more frightening than what you would call a pterodactyl the size of a robin?
Yeah.
Imagine 100 of those.
Or it could look kind of cool, like the little UFOs and Batteries Not Included. Remember those?
I didn't see that movie.
Do you remember like the ads or anything from it, though?
No.
It was basically Cocoon, but set in a tenement and with UFOs rather than the actual aliens.
Okay.
It was very similar, though.
Uh-huh.
I think Don Ameche was in both, maybe.
Yeah, why not? He had that market cornered.
If you can get your hands on Don Ameche, you put him in your movie, buddy.
Yeah, for sure.
So, okay. Where are we at, Chuck?
Well, I think we can hop over to the fact that for many years people thought, we've already mentioned birds, but bats was the other thing
mm-hmm.
that people confused them with. There was an anatomy professor named Samuel Thomas von Summering. And in the 1800s, he incorrectly suggested that these were bats. Another paleontologist named Harry Seeley even wrote a book called Dragons of the Sky,
mm-hmm.
In which he said birds were the descendants of these. And it's understandable why these dudes were wrong. They were doing the best they could. And when you look at those wings, it looks, you know, that membrane, it looks like it would be a bat's wing. But there are some differences.
Yeah, there's some big differences. And you like a bat in particular, I could see confusing it with, right?
Yeah.
Like an ancient bat. Because with a bat, you have four digits,
mm-hmm.
and three of those digits form the bones in the wing, and you got one little digit wiggling free so a bat can climb around with its index fingers, right?
Yes.
With a pterosaur, you have three digits that are free, and then the pinky, the fourth digit, is the one that forms that long, sometimes 10, 20 feet long bone that's the front edge of the wing.
Yeah, that's crazy.
But they had three fingers free. And this is really significant because before they used to think, and if you go back and you look at how pterodactyls were drawn in like the middle of the 20th century, when they weren't in flight, they were probably standing on their back legs. And they realized that this is probably not how pterosaurs stood, that instead, because their forearms were far more powerful than their back legs, they were probably quadrupeds, which meant that they walked on all four legs, putting most of their weight on their front forearms with their three free digits, and their wings tucked off to the side. And they look kind of like a cartoon bulldog walks.
Yeah,
is what I'm seeing. That's what they think now.
Like a cartoon bulldog, not a real one.
Right. Well, I mean, a real bulldog doesn't walk quite like a cartoon bulldog. Cartoon bulldog's more exaggerated and pronounced. You know what I mean?
Sure.
It's a cartoon.
Should we take another break?
Sure.
All right. We'll do that, and then we'll talk a little bit about how they fly and other good stuff right after this.
Pterosaurs.
Hey everybody, Chuck here. Are you thirsty? Well, before you take a sip, have you stopped to think about what's in your water? Many conventional bottled waters contain PFAS, harmful substances known as forever chemicals.
Yeah, but you can drink water as clean as nature intended with Richard's Rainwater.
That's right. Richard's Rainwater collects 100% pure, refreshing drops of rain. Yes, it really is rain. Richard's Rainwater is caught clean before it hits the ground or becomes polluted with pesticides and contaminants that are commonly found in groundwater.
And since rain is naturally pure, there's no need for harsh chemicals or additives. That means Richard's Rainwater contains no added fluoride, no chlorine, no forever chemicals, no microplastics, no nothing. Just pure drops of rain.
That's right. Enjoy the smooth, clean taste of Richard's still rainwater and the long-lasting cold pressured bubbles of Richard's sparkling rainwater, perfect for sipping or mixing into your favorite cocktail. Just visit richardsrainwater.com to find a retailer near you. Enjoy pure, refreshing rainwater. Sip the sky. Hey, everybody. It's halftime and the scoreboard is not looking good. You're feeling low and not sure you can pull out a win. And that's when you have to dig deep, lift your head up, and say to yourself, time to get back in the game. Pull off some bank heists and take as much of your friend's money as you possibly can.
That's right. The smash hit mobile game Monopoly Go lets you compete with your friends to get the most riches and the biggest empire. It's the Monopoly you love, but on your phone, anytime, with tons of new twists, including leaderboards to compare your progress to your buddies.
That's right. You can play on countless dynamic Monopoly boards. You can make your friends bankrupt by smashing their landmarks with a wrecking ball, and you can charge other players rent for your iconic properties.
Plus, you can even work with your friends to crack open community chests in tournaments to get rewards and climb the leaderboard.
So get back out there, put on your game face, and download Monopoly Go, now free on the App Store or Google Play. Hey, everybody. You know, asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest.
That's right. They're committed to high ethical standards and even had to pass a rigorous exam before they could become a CFP professional. They offer financial planning services that take a more comprehensive view of your financial and personal circumstances, and they customize them for your needs.
That's right. Certified financial planner professionals can offer advice on a wide range of issues like reviewing your investment portfolio's allocation, handling an inheritance, rolling over a company retirement plan, building education savings, and so much more. And that's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
Well, now when you're on the road, driving in your truck, why not learn a thing or two from Josh and Chuck? It's stuff you should know.
Stuff you should know.
All right.
All right. So you mentioned they were quadrupedal.
Mm-hmm. Four-footed.
Four-footed. And initially they thought that they would like birds because we see birds do it, and it's probably, especially back in the 1800s, it was... Maybe they're all working off the notion of the easiest solution is probably correct.
Yeah.
Because they would see a bird hop off those back legs and think, well, this is clearly what pterodactyls did.
Yeah, and I never thought about that, but that's exactly what a bird does. It jumps up in the air from its back legs and flaps its wings and then provides lift from that point on using its wings.
Yeah.
I'd never really thought about that, but that's how birds fly.
Yeah, they hop around, and if they want to, and it's funny, one of the other articles you sent, one of those guys believed, the paleontologist believes that it even evolved into flying, that they used to hop around on four legs, and eventually they started jumping higher and higher and then started flapping, and then before you knew it, they were flying.
Yeah, maybe they went from leaping to gliding to flying. And they don't know. Again, they haven't found what you would call a proto pterosaur, like whatever was the link between ancient reptiles and pterosaurs. But that's kind of the current guess right now, is that they evolved from some small light lizard that was good at jumping.
Yeah, and they one of the big keys in finding out, and I don't think you said this, how strong their arms were.
Yeah.
That sort of was a big breakthrough, because when you think of you think it all comes from the legs because they're jumping. But because they found more fossils, they realized they were quadrupedal, and they said, man, they actually have incredibly strong arms and shoulders and these little tiny feet. So not only are they quadrupedal, but a lot of that initial hopping lift may come from the arms and not mm-hmm. the legs at all.
Mm-hmm. So they think now what they do is just basically push themselves off their front arms and legs to an extent and just basically hop up into the air and then start flapping their wings rather than like a bird jumping off of their back legs. Is that what you mean?
Yeah. And then, but most of that comes from the arms and shoulders rather than the feet.
Right.
And the feet, I think, just sort of drag behind and perhaps maybe helped with steering. Is that right?
You can actually divide pterosaurs into two groups depending on when they were around. One started around 150 million years ago, and then one came later. And the first groups had long tails. So if you look at old drawings of pterodactyls, you'll frequently see them with kind of like a long forked devil's tail,
yeah.
You know? And it's actually kind of accurate, they think, that the original ones had longer tails to learn to steer in the air. But then as they got more and more adapted to flying gracefully, they lost their tails. So the later ones, the ones that were around when the Cretaceous period ended suddenly, mostly called Osdarkids, which is not an easy word to pronounce.
No, it's not.
That they'd lost their tails because they had developed other methods of changing how they fly mid-flight.
Right.
So like because the wing membrane was connected to their ankle from their shoulder, with their finger kind of providing the front of the wing, if they altered the angle of their wrist bone or they moved their ankle in and out, it would change the actual dynamics of their wing, and they could dive and lift and do all sorts of other things. This is a big sea change in our understanding of pterosaurs too, because they used to think that they basically had to run and jump off of a cliff
right.
to gain flight.
Or hang like bats.
Yeah, because they were so weird looking and so weirdly developed in different ways. Huge heads, enormous beaks, big head crests, small puny little withered feet. You know, like
Mr. Burns hands,
or yeah, that's a good one, or David Cross in the Titanica segment on Mr. Show.
Yeah,
you're like that, right? That's like a pterosaur's legs. So it didn't make any sense how they flew, but now that we're starting to learn more and more about them, we're like, oh, actually, they had a lot of really really interesting adaptations. Not the least of which was their bones.
Yeah, I mean. Are all of their bones hollow or just those wing bones?
All of them.
Wow. I mean, that made them incredibly light, obviously, but that also ended up being one of the problems in trying to get fossils of these guys, because they were very highly destructible.
Non-fossilizable.
Non-fossilizable.
Do you remember our fossil episode? That was like one of the better old ones, if you ask me.
Yeah, I agree.
I learned a lot on that.
Yeah, we should trot that out in the selects soon.
That is a great idea.
That'd be a good one. They also thought if they were on water, like they had just had a little snack on a lake, that they would use those wings as paddles and just get going that way, pushing off the surface and then flapping until they were, you know, shaking it off 20 feet above the water.
Right, exactly. A lot like marine birds do today, right?
Mm-hmm.
So those bones, like you kind of hit it on the head, they were extremely light, right? They were about a millimeter thick, something like the thickness of a playing card I saw.
That's nuts.
It is super nuts, especially considering that these things were holding up like a bird that was up to 20 feet tall, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or not a bird, a pterosaur.
Yeah, not a pterodactyl.
Man, I just averted so much email, Chuck. Like a millimeter thick bone wall. But the way that their bones were made, they were made of cross sections of basically like plywood. So they were really strong. And then if you cut their bone in two and look down the hollow tube, you would see that there are little struts crisscrossing to provide even more internal support for those bones.
It's amazing.
So you could have a 20-foot tall pterosaur that could actually fly because it was that light. I saw one of the Asdarkids was something like had a 20-foot wingspan, but it probably didn't weigh any more than 20 pounds.
Yeah, and some of these, I mean, what were the largest ones, like 35, 40 feet in wingspan?
Yeah, so about like 10 to 15 meters in wingspan, like the size of like a jet plane, like a fighter jet.
I just flew in my first private jet.
Oh, yeah, how was it?
You know what? First of all, I've always wanted to fly on a private jet, but never thought I would have cause to.
Uh-huh.
Because, you know, unless you're extremely wealthy, you only do that if you get invited to for some strange reason.
Right.
Like, you don't just book it.
You should be on high alert if some wealthy person invites you on the private jet.
And it was awesome. It was as awesome as you think. And the most awesome part of it was the... just the sheer lack of hassle.
Yeah.
Like I parked my car at the little tiny airport here in DeKalb County, walked across the parking lot and into the lobby, and there's literally a guy standing there, a captain, and he was like, "Are you Chuck?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Right this way." And you walked out the back door, and there's a plane, and they say, "Watch your head." And you get on it, and he says, "You ready to go?"
Was it just you?
No. That was okay. Like five of us on an eight-seater.
Everybody was waiting for you.
Yeah, I was the last person to get there. And I was a little stressed, but then I thought, wait a minute. That's the other perk, is they don't leave you.
Yeah.
Like, there's a schedule, but it's not like—
Yeah, you gotta be really late.
But it was cool. I mean, the one we were on was, it's not roomy, so it's not like Air Force One or anything. Like, you feel like you can just walk around. But, like, when I was standing, I'm 5'10", mm-hmm. and if I stood completely straight, my head would brush the ceiling a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But
and you're just like, ugh, private jets.
But no TSA. Like, you just walk on. They fly you there,
mm-hmm.
and then you get off, and you're right there. It's like this, just the lack of hassle. And all I could think of was, like, man, it must be great to be a billionaire.
Sure.
And never have to deal with an airport again.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was kind of cool. But then also, once you're up there, you're kind of like, it's not like life-changing.
Yeah, Yumi actually, I've never flown on one. Yumi flew on one, and she said basically the exact same thing you did, that just the lack of hassle and how fast you get somewhere.
Yeah.
Is just beyond amazing.
Yeah, I mean, it takes away hours and hours of airport crap.
I know. You start to develop like that terrible sensation where your eyes hurt for some weird reason, even though you haven't even gotten on the plane yet. Like, there's a lot of stuff that I'd be happy to leave behind.
Yeah. And it also, when you're going to take off, because it's small, it feels like you're going as fast as you're going. Whereas in a jumbo jet, it really doesn't.
Right.
Like, I was kind of like, man, we're going fast.
Speaking of Yumi and flying, I have an update.
Okay.
Do you remember the story about the Russia visas that we failed to get?
Oh, sure.
I told her that I told that story, and she was like, you said we forgot? And I was like, yeah, we did, right? And she's like, no, we asked like five different people five different times, and we're told we didn't need visas. So I wanted to let you know, Chuck, that we actually are as buttoned up as you think. We were just misinformed.
We got that great email from a new listener that was like, listen to some dumb story about some guy and his dumb visa. I was like, oh, welcome to the show, brother.
Yeah. You should probably
there's the exit
up.
Door.
Was that guy, that one guy?
Uh-huh.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he's very turned off by your aside about your visa story.
Yeah, whatever.
So anyway, thanks for indulging the private jet convo.
Yeah, I'll bet that guy loved the private jet aside.
It'll probably never happen again, but it was basically like riding around on a pterosaur, so that's how I wedged it in there.
Nice work. That is nice. So I'm trying to think of what else. Like, pterosaurs kind of bring out the little inner 10-year-old in me. I don't know if you've noticed, but I'm wearing my little outdoor archaeologist boots.
I see that.
And white pull-up crew socks.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just a total little nerd.
You keep dusting everything in here, too.
I'm not even like one of those dinosaur nerds, but just getting into researching dinosaurs, does it do that to you too? It just kind of draws out like the little kid?
I think so. And I think probably because at least when I was, and you and I were growing up, I feel like public schools just like did such a poor job of talking about these periods.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I remember that. But I also remember dinosaurs being kind of huge in the 80s.
Yeah.
At least they were in Ohio. Was that an Ohio thing?
I don't know. I'm trying to remember. I mean, Jurassic Park obviously changed everything as far
yeah.
as... But when was that?
90s.
Yeah, early 90s.
Yeah, but I feel like dinosaurs were pretty popular among the kids before that. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I hit my head and don't realize it.
I don't know. I know kids... I mean, my daughter loves dinosaurs, so it's a thing.
Yeah, it definitely is a thing. And it's getting to be even more of a thing the more we learn about pterosaurs, too, which is... Somebody called the 21st century the golden age of pterosaur research. So they're expecting big things from the field.
Yeah, and like you said, hopefully they can find that proto-pterosaur. And that's when the community really gets all excited, when they can make those links.
Hey, you know what? Speaking of the community, I read this article in National Geographic, and God bless him, I can't remember the guy who wrote it, but it's called Why Pterosaurs Were the Weirdest Wonders on Wings.
Yeah, it was a good one.
It's a great article. And the guy basically just got into all like the dirty laundry of the pterosaur paleontology community. And apparently they're very well known among paleontologists for just despising each other. Like the pterosaur paleontologists don't like each other, talk smack about each other publicly, and just snipe at one another a lot. Which just makes the whole thing even that much more fascinating, you know?
Huh.
Like they're real competitive and real backbitey.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And in this case, that's a good thing.
Yeah, because they keep pushing one another.
Agreed.
You got anything else?
No.
Are we done with pterosaurs?
I don't have anything else, I don't think.
Okay. Well, if you want to know more about pterosaurs, go to your local natural history museum and say, hey, tell me about that pterodactyl. See if you can stump them. And since I said stump, it's time for listener mail.
I'm going to call this one. Which one is this one? Oh, foot binding. I believe we did this in a select episode.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of our older ones, but a really good one, I think.
Agreed.
And this goes like this. Hey, guys, I'm a soon-to-be grad student from Guangdong, China, and have been a listener for a couple of years now. This is my first time writing in, and it's about foot binding. I talked to my grandmother after listening, remembering she told me that her grandmother had bound her feet. I asked if great-great-grandma had trouble walking, and she said she had never even wobbled a little bit, because it turns out she never made her own little shoes. She just bought toddler shoes for herself.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's called making lemons. That's called making lemonade out of lemons with your feet.
That's right. She said great-great-grandma came from a wealthy family and bound feet were more of a symbol of your family wealth, meaning you don't have to do farming chores, and catering to the male foot fetish at that time. We are not exactly sure when she was born, but we do know that when her daughter, my great-grandmother, was born in 1914, she made sure that her feet were never bound. She also put all of her kids through high school, which was very remarkable back then.
Oh, yeah.
Foot binding is certainly not something that I am proud of. To think that I'm just five generations away from having to get my own feet bound, as opposed to sitting here writing you guys right now, it just says to me how far we've gone. Thanks for the show. By the way, in the draft podcast, Josh was having trouble pronouncing Q-I-N-G dynasty.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Q may be roughly pronounced as T-S.
Oh.
Not exactly the same. So just say Tsing next time. That would do.
I don't even think I tried that one. I tried every other phoneme except for Tsing.
And this is best regards from Ruoi.
Thank you very much, Ruoi. That's pretty cool. And, like, nice sense of perspective, too. If you want to get in touch with us with an awesome story like Ruoi did, you can catch up with us on social media. Just go to our website, stuffyoushouldknow.com, and you will find all of our social media links there. And if you want, send us a good old-fashioned email. Wrap it up, smack it on the bottom, and send it off to stuffpodcasts@howstuffworks.com.
Stuff You Should Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Hey, everybody, are you thirsty? Well, sip on pure, refreshing Richard's Rainwater. Yes, it's really rain, caught clean before it hits the ground. Rain is naturally pure, so there's no need for harsh chemicals or additives. Richard's Rainwater contains no chlorine, no forever chemicals, no microplastics, no nothing. Enjoy the smooth, clean taste of Richard's still rainwater or the long-lasting and cold-pressured bubbles of Richard's sparkling rainwater. Visit richardsrainwater.com to find a retailer near you. That's richardsrainwater.com. Sip the sky. The first cell phone was demonstrated in 1973 by Martin Cooper. But you know what wasn't demonstrated? Shared plans. Over 50 years later, you can save on one line, thanks to Visible. It's true. So switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon for just $25 a month, taxes and fees included. Switch now at Visible.com.
Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
In business, first impressions are everything. And that's why every business owner needs to know about Ruby. Ruby is the virtual receptionist company who screens, transfers, and takes messages 24/7, all while making your customers feel special. You definitely don't want to hire a subpar front desk person. And with Ruby, they engage with your callers in a conversational way, just like your best employee would. Never miss another customer call again. This year, make your business the best it can be. Visit ruby.com today. Or just call them at 844-900-RUBY.